Waiting for. Okay, we're live. Hello. How's everybody doing? We are back at our weekly Fair Care Vote half hour, 40 minutes, depending on how long you have patience and how long I have time. We, last week, were in the middle of, still are, in the middle of a Mishnah, long, very repercussive Mishnah by Hillel HaZaken, who lived around the end of the first century, the beginning of the first century CE as well, about Torah study. And we're waiting. I see that the, here we are. We're back. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm doing this simultaneously on my Facebook page as well as on the show page, so sometimes there are snags. Anyways, we are in the middle of the Mishnah in Aramaic, talking about Torah study. And we are up to three very, very loaded words. Four words. Dela yalif ketila chalav, chayav, or ketala chayav. A person doesn't study, deserves to die. Now that's very, very, very heavy. That's like, wow, really? Ad kedei kach, to that extent? So, in order to, what do people say today? In order to unpack that properly, we need to really take a look and say, what are we talking about? To whom are we talking? What is that addressed? So it's interesting, the way that the commentators on this Mishnah approach the issue says, sometimes I think says a lot more about them than it does about the words, because the words could actually refer to many, many different things. So for example, Dela yalef de getala chayav, a person who doesn't study deserves to die, or it's as if he's already dead. So what are we talking about? What kind of study are we discussing? What kind of intellectual activity is relevant? How does that really pull itself together? So here it's interesting. There are a bunch of commentators who say the truth of the matter is a person who doesn't use his mind really isn't a human being, because what is it that separates us from the animals? And yes, I know all about all of the researches that show the intelligence of chimpanzees and dolphins and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, I think it's pretty clear that human beings are at the top of the intelligence chain. Although I will admit, it is also true that our daily interaction with our fellow human beings doesn't always bear that out. Like one of the things that I get a big kick out of is the fact that in the Middle Ages, when they wanted to sort of like highlight the human intelligence and the uniqueness of people as opposed to animals, they would say that the people have koach hamedaber, they have the capacity to speak. In fact, when the Aramaic translation, when they wanted to translate the words that God made man into a nefesh chaya, into a living being, he turned them into a ruach memalala, a speaking spirit, which indicates that in fact that the that our humanity is expressed, or our superiority is expressed, in our speech. And when you think about some of the stupid things, that people say, you begin to wonder whether that's true. But in principle, anyways, the capacity to communicate and to speak and to talk and to be intelligent and to speak is an indication ostensibly of intelligence. And our intelligence is what makes us human. Therefore, say these individuals, that people that are Luddites, people that are know-nothings, they don't want to know anything, they don't want to read, why should I bother with books? Why should I bother to think? More to the point, a person who doesn't engage those things, such a person really is not really alive, as far as his humanity is concerned. His mind is dead, his brain is dead, and that is a very it's a very serious business, because you have capacities. So this is, in other words, according to this way of looking at the Mishnah, it's a universal issue. Dela yalif ketila chayav. The person who doesn't study might as well be dead, because, you know, he doesn't engage and doesn't list all the things that God, all of the qualities and all of the talents that God gave him. This would actually relate, by the way, to what we talked about last week, because last week we spoke about the fact that people who don't increase their knowledge will end up losing their knowledge or end up dying. similarly, people who are self-satisfied. So I know everything. I don't tell me anything. Or I can live in my little, I'm coming back to my anti-social media thing as we sit on Facebook, right? As person who's self-satisfied, I don't, I live in my little echo chamber, and all the people on Facebook agree with me, and the people who don't agree with me, I'm going to block. I was recently actually blocked by a well-known professor of Jewish studies on the other side of the Atlantic because he didn't like what I said. And therefore, you know, why should he be bothered? So, okay, you know, that's fine. It's my mental health is probably better as a result. But the point is that I know what I know, and don't bother me with other ways of looking at things. That's also a form of death, because ultimately you'll go stale. And if you go stale, then you end up drying up. And as in the case of Alonso Quijano, who later became Don Quixote, you brood and brood and brood till your brain dries up. So that's one way of looking at that, at this verse. However, the overwhelming majority of commentaries see Hillel's words as related directly to Torah study. And it's to that, those lines of interpretation, and to the ideas that come out of them, that I want to devote the rest of the, most of the lesson today. So, number one. I mentioned this last week as well, one of the things which sets Judaism aside, really apart from any other religion, and I did some more research and I still haven't found any other faith or faith community which maintains this position, is that study is the highest act of worship, or study to the side of prayer. But it's at least equal to prayer, and according to many, higher than prayer. And in general, study, the use of one's mind, is an integral part of every single part of one's spiritual life. Let me sort of break that down. Number one. Last week we talked about the fact that prayer and study are, according to many, of equal value. And according to that position, which was characteristic of it's a very ancient tradition, it goes back to the students of Rabbi Meir in the 2nd century CE, a group of whom organized themselves and called themselves the Kahala Kadisha de Yerushalayim, the sacred community of Jerusalem. And they were very careful to divide their time into threes. This is what the Midrash tells us, and they're referred to it elsewhere in rabbinic literature. They would divide their time. A third of their time was devoted to prayer, a third of their time to study, and a third of their time to making a living. Making a living we'll talk about next week in terms of what happens if there's a... do you have a right to take money for Torah, an issue that we've just touched on in the past but really haven't gone into in depth. So why is that? The person reason for that is, number one, because it's a conversation. This is not no original interpretation on my part. Study and prayer are two sides of a conversation. Prayer is what we have to say to God and a privilege that we're given, and Torah study is what God says to us. Okay. But what's important in both cases is the fact that the act of study is an act not only of intellection. You're not just, we did this again last week. It's not just bringing in material. It's a religious gesture. You're encountering God. And in fact, the Talmud on a number of occasions says that the act of Torah study is a reenactment of the revelation at Sinai, which is why the Talmud in Brachot, for example, says that when you come to study, you should enter into the act of study in a sort of state of mind of awe, just as the Jews were at, or the Israelites were at Mount Sinai. So that's number one. So dalak yalif katala chayav, if you don't study, you'll die. You're going to die spiritually, because you're basically cutting yourself off from your relationship with God. More importantly, I don't think anybody would disagree with the determination, or with the statement that in fact studying is actually more important on some levels than prayer, for the simple reason that that's what God has to say to me. What's more important I mean, you can understand those who say, I'd rather cut my time in prayer and study more because I'd rather be on the receiving end than asserting or asking for stuff. But that's not the point. The point is that Jewish spirituality, traditional Jewish spirituality, is always predicated on study. And it's not just study of halacha, and it's not just study of mitzvot. In fact, one of the interesting things here is the fact when you look... I think we've talked about this on a number of occasions, that traditional Judaism is really composed of two parts which are very, very different, and it's very strange to see how they could get along. But they're both necessary. One is to study Torah in the narrow sense, in the sense of we have to know how to do the mitzvot and halakha and all kinds of stuff, fine. But on the other hand, you have to develop your soul. If you don't develop your soul, then your observance of mitzvot is going to be totally robotic and ultimately meaningless. It'll become fossilized. So you need to develop your soul. But how do you develop your soul? So there were two large traditions in that, or three large traditions that sort of undertake to help people develop spiritually and develop their relationship with God. So one is philosophy, which has an emotional part of it, by the way. It's not just a bunch of philosophes sitting on the Seine and drinking limonada avec menthe or coffee. But it's very, very passionate. If you read Maimonides properly, you'll see that Maimonides, even though he was very understated, was a very passionate individual. His letters prove that because he was like very out there. And mysticism. Mysticism is a whole other ballgame. Mysticism is you let yourself go and you let your soul go and rise up to higher levels. And then there's Musar, ethics, developing oneself ethically on one's own and also in relationship with other people. Strikingly, all three of them, especially mysticism. Mysticism, you think about people, you know, we think about mysticism, we think about going to India and getting their own mantra and sitting there for hours and mindless and losing their individuality. That's not how Jewish mysticism works. Never mind ethics and philosophy. Jewish mysticism is accomplished by studying the Zohar, by studying the works of Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, by studying the works of the great Hasidic masters. In other words, even though one has mystical experiences, one achieves them through interaction with study. So Talmud Torah, actually, that the act of intellection, the act of using your mind, is critical to every single part of one's Jewishness. There is no moment, or very few moments, upon which one doesn't engage in interaction with words, with books, with ideas. Now they inspire one's soul to go to different levels. But d'la yalef ketala chayav, if you don't study, you will become spiritually fossilized. You will become spiritually desiccated. You will become spiritually and emotionally dead. So that what Hill could well be saying, and this is one line of interpretation has it this way, is that our study of Torah has to be very, very broad and very, very all encompassing. In other words, it's not just the narrow curriculum which is traditionally taught in Jewish schools or in yeshivot or in ulpanot. In fact, I'm not so sure if it works anymore. One of the most revolutionary ideas that developed in the 19th century was that of Rabbi Chaim Volozhin in Lithuania, who thought that actually you could achieve everything. You don't need philosophy. You don't need mysticism. All you need is to study Gemara, and the Gemara and studying Gemara can provide all of your spiritual needs, not just your need for knowledge to know how to be Jewish and how to observe. And that seems to have worked in some places for a certain amount of time. I'm not sure it works anymore. And what happens is that we've lost touch. Even much of the observant world has lost touch with the incredible riches of works that are available to study and which can enhance our lives. And we don't devote time to them for the simple reason that, Gemara is above all. Now, I'm the last person that's not going to say students study Gemara, students study Halacha. Certainly should. But you need to make time to study things which will expand your mind and your soul in other ways, whether it's the Hasidic masters or whether it's Jewish philosophy or whatever the whatever the case might be. And here, to this, I actually have to give credit for the formulation to my teacher, Professor Yitzhak Twersky, who I think I mentioned already last week. All right. Anyway, because he's the one that sort of like developed the conceptual framework within to understand this this sort of dynamic. So study is always part of everything Jewish, no matter what. There are other... Okay, so that's another way of looking at this Mishnah. Interestingly, there is a... one line of interpretation which pops up, and it pops up in interesting places, so that apparently it's not dependent on any one historical time or any one personality or any one approach. So, for example, what I'm about to tell you actually appears in a comment that's attributed to Rashi. It's not Rashi. It came out of Rashi's sort of ambiance. And Rabbeinu Yonah Girondi, who came from Spain. And it pops up, interestingly, I found, I did a quick search for a change to see what popped up on the internet. The overwhelming majority of people who have put up their shiurim or sources and stuff like that on the Mishnah on the net, at least the ones that I could find, that came up by several hundred thousand hits, so I couldn't check all of them, but I sort of try to take an impression as to what people said. And it's an interpretation which is somewhat grammatically problematic, but nevertheless very, very profound. Dela yalef katala chayav clearly means anyone who doesn't study really should die. I mean, he really is killing himself. He contributes nothing to society. Okay. Now, by the way, before we get to this other line, I've just hit me, that dela yalef, anyone who doesn't study... doesn't contribute to society, he's like dead to society. That means that every single person, and this is something I cannot emphasize enough, Judaism is fundamentally democratic when it comes to Torah study. What do I mean? I mean that that every single person has something to contribute. Every single person, as the Rav Soloveitchik used to say, has a place in the Masorah community. It doesn't have to be, we're not restricted to great geniuses who know the entire Talmud. In fact, on the contrary, a lot of people I know who have restricted themselves to Talmud, they're limited in all kinds of other ways. Everybody has certain strengths that they can contribute and certain insights, and everybody's insights should be respected and solicited. And there are people who specialize in different parts of Torah, which don't receive... receive their due credit, even though they contribute to the community. There are people who know Chumash better. There are people who know Tanakh better, Tanakh in general better. There are those who know Midrash better. There are those who study philosophy better. They know Kabbalah better. The degree to which you can contribute your insights everybody's insights are valuable. Everybody's questions are valuable. And to sit there and say, I can't open my mouth because so-and-so is smarter than me, in some ways, but not in other ways. You can't, the Rambam, it's in a beautiful comment, in the third chapter of Talmud Torah says that Israel was bestowed, the Jewish people were given three crowns by God. One was kingship, one was priesthood, and the other is the Torah. So kingship was given to the house of David, and priesthood was given to the descendants of Aaron, and the Torah is sitting there, and anybody who wants to participate is not only is invited and able to come and participate, recognizing your qualities, recognizing your advantages, and also your limitations. But that should be true of everything. In any event, so there's something fundamentally democratic about that. Now, that's important because of this other way of interpreting the Mishnah that I mentioned. And that is, Dela Yalef Ketala Chayav is interpreted not to mean anybody who doesn't study deserves to die, but rather anybody who doesn't teach deserves to die. Now, the truth is that if it really were the Yalif, if it really was to teach, rather, then the word should have been lemelaf, which is the proper way of writing the verb to teach in Aramaic. So you have to ask yourself, whoa, what was it? What was it about the importance of stressing the centrality of teaching that caused all those commentators, and this is across the boards and across the generations, to, I don't want to say misinterpret, but to add a dimension to Hillel's words, which isn't there at first glance. Apparently, now since the comment is found in the 11th century in Germany and in the 13th century in Provence and in Spain, and then later on in Egypt, the Al-Sheikh says it, and then you find it all over the net, meaning something of contemporary interest, contemporary importance. Obviously, the need to stress the importance of teaching is a moment that is permanent, that there apparently was a problem with getting people to teach, which doesn't go away, and which caused generation after generation of commentator to emphasize its importance and to take liberties with the words themselves to get that message across. That's really remarkable. That's something which is obviously there was a very serious urgency involved, which led them to this somewhat, you want to call it, I don't know what to call it. You want to call it, what should we call it? Irresponsible or daring? Interpretive daring of the passage? However you want to look at it, it's definitely something to call we have to call our attention to. So, what are we talking about? Why is it so important to teach? So first of all, if you don't teach, you basically, according to some, if you don't teach, what you've done is you've basically missed the point of your encounter with God when you study. Because when you open whatever sefer you're learning, whether it's Chumash, whether it's Navi, whether it's Ksuvim, whether it's the Gemara, Mishnah, it doesn't really matter. What's happening? God or his representatives, those who are passing on the Masorah, are actually teaching you. So you have the benefit of their wisdom. You're supposed to imitate them. More than that, God is known as the Notena Torah, or as for those of you who daven in the morning, the Birkata Torah, the bracha that you say over Torah study, everyone says over every day, is Hamalame Torah Liamo Yisrael. Blessed art thou, O God, who teaches Torah to his people Israel. Now let's be very clear. The fundamental, Maimonides says this, and he's not the only one. The fundamental principle, the Chazal, I say it implicitly. The fundamental principle of Jewish morality is imitatio Dei, is imitating God. God does this, he's rachum, he's compassionate, he's merciful, and so on. So that's how we know what is moral. Our morality is rooted in mimicking God as we understand his deeds, as recounted in the Torah. Okay? So study is one of the things that God, I mean, teaching is one of the things God does. My teacher of Soloveitchik Zatzal used to always say, that all he is a Malamed. I'm a teacher. And they say, you're just a teacher. A Malamed is the guy you pay $30 an hour, maybe, or $10 an hour, or $2 an hour, whatever it is, to teach Shalif Beis to the Bar Mitzvah kid. He's the lowest of the low, right? So Soloveitchik says, Mapitom. Who says? Rabbeinu Shalom himself is called a Malamed. A Malamed Torah Lamo Yisrael. There could be no greater enterprise. The act of study by itself demands that we pass on what we study to everybody, irrespective of who they are. And in fact, if you take a look at the prayer book, if you take a look at Piyutim, everywhere you go, Lilmod Ulamed always goes together. Studying and teaching goes together. Now, every single person, again, this is a fundamentally democratic idea because it means that everyone is obliged to teach Torah to other people as they know. One of the things that one of the things that I've always, well, I'll tell you a story. On a number of occasions, on many occasions, I had the opportunity to sit and to talk about various issues with the late Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was the Rosh Hashiva of YU and the president of Yeshiva University, and we developed over the course of the years a very fine and very, very warm relationship. He once asked me, we're talking about the future of the rabbinate and how can we spread Torah more in this case in the United States. And I said, you know what? I think we should take a cue from the Jesuits. He says, the Jesuits? Of all people, the Jesuits? Not them, the Jesuits? I said, think about it. Who were the Jesuits? The Jesuits were an order in the time when the Catholic Church needed to fight back against the Reformation. So the Jesuits were founded in order to dress almost like normal people and go out among the people and teach every single person. In other words, by being involved in the broader world, that's how you get at people, as opposed to the priests and the monks that were in the churches. You had to have people come to the prayer, to services, in order to be able to hear them. I said, similarly, aside from rabbis and shuls, every single Orthodox Jew, every single knowledgeable Jew, should be a Jesuit. In other words, you're not just going out in the world and keeping your religiosity and your things to yourself. You have a moral obligation to go out and be available and to make clear what you know and spread it to people who don't know. My son tells a story that when he was working in a certain law firm, he was the only religious person in the law firm, and as a result, he is the person that people asked. They didn't know any rabbis, so whenever they had a question, they would ask him. He was the Jesuit, so Rabbi Lamb didn't think it was such a great idea or such a good image. I maintain that I was right. That watching the way that religious people interact in the broad world in Israel, especially when you have so many people that are interested and so little knowledge available, and that which is available is from religious people, from rabbis, is expressed in terms that no, I don't get too strong here, in terms that no person can really appreciate or understand, or it's sort of closed shop talk. We're missing an incredible opportunity. So therefore, little modal lamed, every single the person who doesn't study deserves to die because they're letting society die. Bishotef, as we sort of flow through life, we have an obligation, every single person according to what they know, to share with everybody else. Especially if they're asked. I don't know, it's my rabbi. No. If you're asked, you should look it up and say, "Hi, this is the answer," or "This is what I think." Because the person you sitting next to the other guy at work, eventually when we go back to work, is far more accessible and less scary than some rabbi. So Delaya Leif the Kitala Chayav, every single person is, all right, I won't say Jesuit, but every single person is an emissary of God who is supposed to teach. No matter what the circumstances are. And sometimes it'll be awkward, but you know what? We're not supposed to be Muranos. Oh, so therefore, that begins, so against that background, you begin to understand why would a person keep things to himself? Right? Seems to be a pretty obvious question. Why would people keep things to themselves? Why would they not share what they know? So it could be because they're arrogant. I once had an encounter when I was in Kollel, I came upon a very difficult issue. And I really didn't understand that it had to do with purity and impurity and death and all kinds of stuff. And I asked somebody who was in the Kollel who had a reputation for being very well versed in this stuff. So I went up to him, and he sort of looked down his nose at me and said, "You're asking me this question? First look up this and this and this and this and this, and then maybe I'll talk to you." So I felt like this. I felt like garbage. And as it happened, the answer wasn't that difficult. I mean, when somebody explained the basic principles underlying the issue, For those of you who are familiar with the issue was Sof Tuma Latzeis. I don't want to go into it right now. It is an issue I do understand. But anyways, but that was a long time ago. Some people think they're too good to share what they know. Who are you to ask me? That is a fundamentally perverted approach. Torah is not to be kept to yourself. Some people maybe keep Torah themselves because they're embarrassed or they're shy. We're all shy. We all have to overcome our shyness in one way or another. Otherwise, we don't get anywhere. And the Torah demands that we not be shy. Finally, I mean, I'm going a little bit over time, but finally, there's something else. It may very well be that those who interpreted this line as meaning you must teach as opposed to just study may very well have been of the opinion that you didn't have to change the words. Because it may very well be that the act of study by itself engenders in everyone who has any sensitivity whatsoever not just the desire to teach, the desire to share, but the physical need. Maimonides in the second part of the Moreh Nevuchim, chapter 37, describes the experience of the prophet. He describes how when the prophet receives his inspiration from God, a message from God, how he does it. This is according to Maimonides. He hooks into the same. I'm using contemporary lingo, but it's more or less the same thing. His mind hooks into a channel where he receives God's message, and he is filled up with God's message, with what Maimonides and others call the divine overflow, and that fills him up and must be shared. It must flow not only into him, but out of him. He at the end of that chapter, he says, and that's how we can understand what Jeremiah said. Jeremiah, who didn't always have such positive things to pass on, said, I try to keep God's word in me, because he didn't want to hurt anybody. He didn't want to get mad, yelled at himself. He said that I tried to keep God's word in with me, and I couldn't. It was like a fire within me. I had to let it go. I had to let it out there. And I remember Professor Tversky saying more than once that this, and Rav Soloveitchik, I used to quote this as well, that this is the best expression of the experience of the teacher that he ever found. The need to teach Torah, the need to teach what you know, is not just a command. It is a natural outgrowth of the act of study. It's not just an intellectual need. Sorry. It's not just intellectual need. It's a physical need. And as a result, one has to teach. No choice. So therefore, if you keep the fire within you, you will end up, if you keep the fire within you, it'll burn you. Therefore, giving is the only way to live. We're back. What I said was that, sorry for the phone call that came in on my phone, that the act of study engenders, forces you to teach. If you keep it inside, you won't be able to control yourself. You won't be able to continue living. You won't be able to get along. As the rabbis themselves say, Yoter mi mishaegel rotze linok hapara rotza lahanik, more than the calf wants to nurse, the cow wants to give of its milk and nurse its child. And I can tell you myself that's my most frustrating moments and hours, my family will tell you, is when I can't teach, when I can't reach the largest audience possible, when I can't give, because otherwise there's no reason to simply store up information and keep it to yourself. It's the ultimate in selfishness. Okay. We will continue on the next part of the Mishnah next week. Everybody, those of you who are on their way to getting their vaccines, get your vaccine. I got my second shot yesterday. Eventually, we'll be able to do this in the shul. That would be really in the Tel Aviv International Synagogue, which sponsors this. Everybody take care of them. Take care of yourselves. And we will see you next week.